Ah, there you are. Apologies for the late arrival of this week's podcast from Radio Today. I could blame Arsenal for keeping me up on Tuesday night, or indeed PowerPoint for freezing a presentation, which I then had to rework on Keynote. But really, it was just poor time management, so sorry. Anyway, I hope the following is worth the wait. In it, you'll hear a moving tribute to a former Pennine Radio DJ and legendary record plugger, David Lloyd's Radio Moments, the latest news, and a celebration of the life, work and waffle of John Peel.
Thank you very much. Start the theme music, lads. And on this week's Top Gear, we have Savoy Brown, Medicine Head and Renaissance, basically, and that's about all. This is, and a lot of records, of course, besides, mustn't overlook them. This is from Canned Heat, and they're shortly to be touring over here. And this is a new single from them. It's called Let's Work Together. What a sound notion. Sound notion.
The Radio Today programme, with Broadcast Bionics, creators of Phonebox and Oasis. Welcome to the social studio.
Whether it's a labour of love or an exercise in OCD journalism, David Kavanagh's new book is a truly remarkable thing. Good Night and Good Riddance catalogues all of John Peel's BBC music shows from 1967 to his death in 2004. And last week, David was on stage at the Islington for the latest Word in Your Ear. David Hepworth and Mark Allen officiated, and I was invited along too. Here's an extract which starts with David Kavanagh recalling the first time he heard Peel during a family holiday in 1977.
I think the first thing I remember him playing was The Boys of the Loch. Thanks, mate. You know, that's just what a 12-year-old kid from Northern Ireland wants to hear. And then he played something by, I think, Prince Farai, again, you know, over my head. Then he played the Sex Pistols. And I was very interested in the idea that this guy who I had in my mind as being quite old, he was probably 39 or 38, but to a 12-year-old, that's very old, endorsed punk, endorsed reggae, and endorsed Irish folk within the space of 9 minutes. So that first show, even though I didn't necessarily like those three pieces of music, gave me so much to think about that I probably thought it's worth persevering with this guy. And by the end of 77, I was listening to him as many nights as I could stay awake for. Yeah.
So when did he enter your life, Trevor, as a listener?
I listened to him on Pirate Radio London when he arrived there in 1967. And my friend at school, Alan, and I were big fans of John Peel because he just played all this weird stuff. And we didn't really know anything about him except he was different from Tony Blackburn and the other DJs. And then Alan came to school one day and said, John Peel's opening a fete at a girls' school just near where I live. Now, these are not the stories you tell to my learned friends. Yeah. Is there anyone from Yew Tree here? So we found out where it was and we went along. And there was John with the very long hair and the sandals, and he was opening the fete at this public school for girls. And he did a little speech, which went basically like, I don't know what I'm doing here. Oh, we said we wouldn't do impersonations, did we?
Do you? Yes. Thankfully, you did.
Is that your impersonation?
No, it's finished now.
He's Welsh.
But he thanked us very much for coming and said he didn't know why he was there. And then he signed for me a copy of the programme for this fete. Which I still have to this day, which says, Love and Peace, John Peel.
Very good.
Big hero.
Can you remember when you first...
God, well, I've listened to the radio. You and I have talked about this loads of times. There's things you can still remember when you described Emerson, Lake and Palmer as being a waste of talent and electricity. I remember him playing a thing in 1982. David Bowie had a single called Cat People, brackets, Putting Out Fire. I can remember he said to Fire, one imagines being the name of the cat in question. But I remember because he used to be on every festival when I was a kid. I went to every single rock festival. John Peel was always, I'm sure people remember, he was always the guy playing the records. And at Lincoln Festival, a load of hippies set fire to a hayfield. And he said, you were refrained from doing that because if you were arrested, we couldn't afford the bail, which I thought was hilarious. You know, I was 16 or something. Yeah. But yeah, that's... I can remember,
it must have been about 1968 or something like that. I can remember him playing Wheels of Fire, the live version of Crossroads by Cream, and said, for those of you who still think Eric Clapton's human, have a listen to this. And I think he was being flattering.
Yeah, he loved.
In years later, he would probably be ironical. You know what I mean? Using exactly the same kind of formal words.
See, that's a really good point. He loved Clapton. If there was one kind of untouchable god of Top Gear, it would have been Clapton. And it's weird because by 93, when he sat in for Jackie Brambles for that strange week on Radio 1 at lunchtime...
it's unimaginable.
He had the job of reading out the album chart, and he said number 5, Eric Clapton, Unplugged, If Only.
You should just explain the structure of your book. It's fascinating because you went back to, is it in Caversham? They have where did you go? They've got, explain what happened because you've got all the details of his program.
Well, I started by, you can hear about 500 or 600 of them online. You can find them and you can hear them, you can download them, you can save them, you can do whatever you want with them, catalogue them. They're there to hear. They will give you a reasonable flavour of his shows from 67 to the final show he ever did. There are gaps, obviously, and some of them are quite serious gaps, and to fill those gaps, you have to go to Caversham, where the BBC's written archive is stored on microfilm, and there you can see the history of Radio 1 day by day. So you thread in a spool of microfilm, January 1971, for example, right? So Saturday morning, the 1st of January, will come up and it'll be Ed Stewpot Stewart presenting Junior Choice, and you will see 3 pages of every single record that he played and what labels they're on and how long they last. So you keep spooling and you get to Emperor Roscoe's show, and then you get to whatever, finally you get to Top Gear in the afternoon, and then you can see Soft Machine, Vivian Stanshall, Ivor Cutler, Chris McGregor's Brotherhood of Breath, all this stuff, right?
And that was middle of Saturday afternoon, wasn't it, Trevor? Do I remember?
Yeah, he started on Radio 1 doing this show called Top Gear, produced by Bernie Andrews, which was on a Saturday afternoon, and he co-presented it. So one of the...
Tell everybody.
Okay, well, the clip that I brought is from the very first Top Gear.
Oh, you've got one.
Yeah, yeah. And this is to Peel with Pete Drummond, who is... second from the left in the front row with the Savile Row suit on. Third from the left.
One of my favourite groups in the whole world that probably a great number of people have never heard of, Captain Beefheart and his Magic Band. And I'd like to play this one especially for Shirley, with whom I saw this group in Los Angeles. It's called Yellow Brick Road.
The following tone is a reference tone, recorded at our operating level. Road from Captain Beefheart and his Magic Band. There's so many fabulous groups over on the West Coast, aren't there, John? You know, they're doing so many different things.
There are indeed beautiful groups, and they all have nice things to do, and none of them ever get heard, except, of course, on Top Gear.
Except, of course, on Top Gear, yes. Right.
Gentle cat.
So that's... there is a different tone, isn't there, early on? Tell us about that, Dave.
Well, what intrigued me and what made me think that maybe there's a book in this was that he does sound like two completely different human beings at the beginning and end of his career as a British broadcaster. He's clearly not. He's the same guy. But maybe he had different outlooks and values. Maybe the times were sufficiently different that he made sense in the context of what he's saying there. I just thought, well... If Peel is a chameleon, then it's worth following him through all the different phases and that gets him from psychedelia to punk to drum and bass to grindcore or whatever. Clearly, he is the same person for the duration of his life, but maybe we all change, and I think
Do you think there's one particular thing he was looking for? Because it's really interesting in the book that you find him championing all these groups that some he stuck with and still played later on, and some he's appalled by. You know, the Eric Claptons, the Mark Bolans, you know, he's just ashamed that he ever liked them. But is there something all the way through that would have excited him? Was it about the newness of what he was doing, or just something adventurous about them?
I think he may have had a strange attitude towards the past. You may not remember, but you sent me to his house once to interview him for Select magazine.
I did, yeah.
because there was his manager Clive Selwood was putting out a box set on this little label he had, Strange Fruit. That's right, and there weren't that many CD box sets out at the time, so we thought this looks quite interesting. It wasn't Peel Sessions, but it was Peel. It was bands that Peel had first played, and some of them were from the 60s, like Cream or whoever, and then into the punk years, and then the Mary Chain and the Pogues and the Wedding Present and so on. So it seemed fairly comprehensive, and I went down to Suffolk to speak to him. He immediately wasn't interested in this box set. He pretended that he didn't know that it was coming out. He said that he wasn't going to be playing it. He was much more interested in what was going to be in the next show. And it had something to do, and I've never got to the bottom of him. I wasn't his biographer, but my suspicion is that he was a nostalgic person, maybe in private, but when it came to music, he wanted to constantly draw a line under what had happened and almost deny. He had a way of telling anecdotes about people, and Trevor will know, when DJs tell anecdotes about famous stars, they make sure they're in those anecdotes, you know, with the arm around the star at Stringfellows. Peel had a way of telling stories about Bowie and Bolan. He didn't even appear in the anecdotes. He was modest to the point of almost nullifying his existence in these people's careers. Not only was he not taking credit for the impact he'd had on British music, when after all, he, more than any DJ in the history of Radio 1, could claim that he'd had an impact on British music, but he was almost writing himself out of history.
And he was very wounded when those two people, in particular, he felt abandoned him.
Bowie, you know, and Bolan.
Moved, yeah, they moved on to better things.
I don't think Bowie was particularly wounding to him, because they were never close friends. Bowie just sort of drifted away from him, but Bolan, who was his best friend, excommunicated him. But bear in mind that Bolan wasn't just being a prick. Peel had told Bolan that his new songs were shit. He played Get It On and said, "Get it on, I couldn't wait to get it off." He was going, "Mark, what are you doing? All these number one hits, you had it. Sitting on a carpet with an acoustic guitar while Steve Peregrine tapped away at the bongos. That was it, Mark. You've blown the formula, Mark. All this success and fame."
The key to him that helped me unlock him when I produced his radio show and then later was his boss at Radio 1 was it began to dawn on me that there's John Ravenscroft and then there's John Peel. And John Peel is an invention of John Ravenscroft. You know, he goes off to America and he has to call himself John Ravencroft when he's on the radio, pretending that he comes from Liverpool, whereas actually he comes from the Wirral, which is where that bizarre accent comes from. It's a boy from public school trying to sound like George Harrison. But then he comes back to England and they give him this name on pirate radio. You could call yourself John Peel, they say. So off he goes to be John Peel. And I think John Peel is the character who played the records and was looking for something different all the time, hated the idea that whether it was Janis Long or Kid Jensen or Richard Skinner might find a record before he did. And so he pushed the boundaries and to the point where he's playing unlistenable stuff. But meanwhile, there was John Ravenscroft, who was the guy who loved his family very, very much. If you ever met him for more than 10 minutes, that's what he wanted to talk about, apart from Liverpool Football Club, was his wife and kids. And he had the perfect family home. He would work very hard at almost anything to keep them in the style in which he thought they had grown accustomed. And eventually, before he died, the real John Ravenscroft emerged doing Home Truths. I think that was more the real John than we heard for 20 years of him playing records on Radio 1.
With respect, I would just like to say one thing. I don't think it's so much that they were Jekyll and Hyde. I think if Mick Houghton is here tonight, Mick and I did the Wimbledon Book Festival a couple of Sundays ago, and Darren Heyman from Hefner was there, and Darren did a session once from Peel Acres, and I said, "Well, how did you get on with Peel? And, you know, did you become friends?" He said, "It was really difficult to become friends with him because he wouldn't talk about music. The only person who seemed to relate to him from our band was the drummer, who was a football fan." I think music for Peel was a private world and had been since Shrewsbury School. And I think the Peel show was 2 hours of him letting us into his private world. Didn't mean that he necessarily told us what he thought of all those records. Sometimes he would make weirdly jokey comments about them that made you wonder if he'd even listened to them. But he was listening to them, and they affected him very deeply. And sometimes, as in the case of Roy Orbison or the Bundu Boys or whoever, he would cry. Or the Undertones, Teenage Kicks.
You won't believe this, of course, but I'm feeling kind of humble tonight because this is the last Radio 1 programme to be broadcast before we lumber over to 275, 285 metres. Mind you, for VHF listeners, things will change not one iota. And do we have a special programme for you? No, not really, but we've got quite a good one.
If you want to hear more from that Word in Your Ear session, go to wordpodcast.co.uk. David Kavanagh's book is called Good Night and Good Riddance. We've heard a couple of the clips I took along on the night, but we didn't get a chance to play all of them, so I thought I might play you some more examples of John Peel at the microphone. First of all, here he is in 1982 talking about his perfumed garden show on Pirate Radio London 15 years earlier.
Quite clearly, if I sent a demo tape of myself to any radio station on earth, they'd call all of their mates in to listen. You know, like, listen to this. You know, can you believe it? But the chap who lived next door to my mother at that time in Notting Hill was in some way connected with Radio London, so he sent me down there, and I suppose they knew at that time they were going to have to close down shortly. So they didn't even ask for an audition, which was just as well. And I said, I've been working in California. I thought, oh, it must be really hot.
Oh, that's amazing. It's called Good Morning, Good Morning, and once again, they're still there. I think what we're doing is going into another track of the second version of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, so I think I'll leave that one to Peter Drummond, who'll be with you in just about 2.5 minutes on Radio London. You've been listening to the brand new Beatles album, heard for the first time exclusively, of course, on Radio London. It's called Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and you've also been listening to, what's this program called? It's got a special name. Where It's All Happening or something, or, yeah, It's All Happening. There you go, telling you where to go this weekend and all the excitement that's going on in and around London and all over our area.
When I first got out of the ship, I used to do a regular Top 40 programme. And somebody used to have to do a double shift. Somebody would have to do the midnight to two shift before the transmitters were closed down. And this was always seen as a bit of a bind, really, because everybody else wanted to go up and watch blue movies upstairs. Actually, that's not entirely fair, but there was a certain amount of that going on, or people just wanted to go and have a drink and watch TV or go to bed or something. And so I volunteered to do it, and when it dawned on me, as it dawned fairly quickly, that nobody on the ship was actually listening to what I was doing, and indeed neither were any of the people at the Radio London office in London, in Curzon Street, I dispensed with the format entirely. I stopped running the ads and things and reading the weather and eventually abandoned the news as well and started playing all of these records, you know. And it wasn't until actually, or so legend has it, I mean, I don't know if this is actually true or not, but apparently Brian Epstein phoned Radio London and said, hey, what a great idea. You know, they're sort of like, what idea? And knew nothing of it. And they switched on and to the programme one night and absolutely horrified because I was doing all this sort of peace and love and stuff, you know, which, of course, at the time I believed, I still do believe in a way, you know. But, I mean, I was getting, like, 10 times as much mail as the rest of them put together, but from all over Europe, you know, because there was so much interest in all of this.
There really is actually a magic record. It's one of these things that you look at it on the turntable, like you're expecting it to drift away and disappear. It is so beautiful. There's so much to that. And I went up during that record to have a look at the night, which, incidentally, is very beautiful. So if you're anywhere near a window, go out and look at it and breathe and perhaps yell, I love you, into the night again.
Here's another clip from John on Top Gear on Radio 1 in 1967.
Purple Convention, and that's our current single, Meet on the Ledge, and they're on our special pre-Christmas Top Gear. It's not special at all, it's just an ordinary one, but it's next week anyway, and I hope you'll listen to that. For those who actively care about such things, I still have the jaundice, you see, and which is as a result of listening to so much liver-expanding music, I expect, during the past few months. And I was supposed to go up to Birmingham after the programme, but I just had the most amazing sort of pain in the region of my liver. I also don't want to go into all the biological details, it's rather squalid, but I don't think I'm going to be able to go. So if Pete Drummond's listening, he might as well go up there himself. Anyway, he's a lot nicer than I am. Here's Duster Bennett, and this is called I'm going to wind up ending up, or I'm going to end up winding up with you. I don't know.
After John embraced punk in the 1970s, journalists often called on him to be a kind of spokesman for the new music. So in 1977, he was asked to defend the Sex Pistols' God Save the Queen.
My own view is that it's a great deal of fuss about nothing. I mean, I remember in the days when the Rolling Stones first started, everybody used to think they were outrageous, you know, and the people going into the papers and saying that they never bathed and that they were violent and vicious and nasty people. The great problem has been that the Sex Pistols record has come along in the middle of the Jubilee, so everybody looks at, like, the first couple of lines of the song. It's a simple song which says, as I understand it anyway, that society dehumanises, and it dehumanises from the top on down, and nobody escapes this, which I think is something that's well worth saying.
Now, as we heard, John's greatest passion apart from music and his family was Liverpool FC. Here he is opening a Radio 1 show in 1982.
Well, guess who's back on top of the First Division tonight? It sounds like a blinder of a match. Forest leading 3-2 at half-time at Anfield. Liverpool won 4-3 in the end. Hodgson 2, Souness and Rush. And anyway, into the programme, we've got the Sisters of Mercy and the Beat amongst the records. Comsat Angels, the Gun Club, a little surf music, because I like you. Red Lorry, Yellow Lorry, Lee Perry, Hunters and Collectors, Personal Column, Deutsche Amerikanische Freundschaft, Ludus, The Birthday Party, French Impressionists, The Mad Professor, Meat Puppets, Sunny A Day, and to start the programme, Dead or Alive.
And one final clip. The Radio 1 DJ Panto was a ghastly annual ritual at Radio 1. Peel always took part, however reluctantly, and on this occasion he's reading an excruciating poem. Note the mention of schoolgirls, or on second thoughts, does.
Snow White's the name. You all must know my claim to fame. I live inside a woodland den, alone except for seven men. With all these males around the house, it is not rare to hear them grouse. We're bored and want something to do. So I bought each one a radio. They each became the greatest fan of just one BBC programme. They'd hurry up the evening meal, lest they should miss the great John Peel. His Top Gear is a wondrous thing, all shimmering in greens and reds, a witching screen of melody, beloved of schoolgirls, freaks and Teds. He himself is modest, kind, a rugged, daring, lovely man. To his true worth, he remains as blind as only a Liverpool supporter can.
High time we had some 2015 news. Now, here's Roy Martin.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics.
Thank you, Trevor. UTV is changing its name and concentrating on radio and online ventures only after agreeing to sell its television stations in Northern Ireland and the Republic to ITV for £100 million. The future is bright. Future is also looking good for Share Radio as it confirms it will join Digital 2 next year in place of the proposed Talk Business radio station by UTV, which, when you look at it from a business angle, makes perfect sense. And John Gaunt's on radio station, Talk To Me Radio, has launched. You can hear Gaunty each morning with his opinions and all from 10 o'clock every day. That's the very latest from radiotoday.co.uk. I'm Roy Martin.
Broadcast Bionics, creators of Phonebox and Oasis, offer you elegantly integrated products and intelligent one-stop shopping for all your studio needs. Discover a full range of innovative studio products. Play out by Wide Orbit, Music Master Scheduling, Stirlitz, Newsboss, Larvo, Telos, Axia, Omnia, Digigram and Commotion. Visit bionics.co.uk today.
Everyone at Radio Today was really sorry to hear of the death recently of Stuart Coxhead. Lots of people who worked in commercial radio and in BBC radio, particularly in the north of England in the 70s and then later in London in the 80s, will remember Stuart, one of the great legendary pluggers to UK radio. And another great legendary plugger is Terry Doherty, who's on the line now to talk to us about Stuart. Terry, you worked with Stuart, didn't you, in those very early days?
I did, yes. Stuart gave me my very first job in the music industry.
And what was plugging like in those days? Well, presumably you were travelling around with a great suitcase of vinyl everywhere.
Well, I had an estate car, because I started as a junior promotion manager in 1977. And this was for Phonogram Records, and I was the Northern rep for Lancashire and Yorkshire. And Stuart had an office, a Phonogram office, based in Leeds. And I used to drive round to all the radio stations. And as I say, it was boxes of vinyl. And we used to go into the radio stations and actually sit with the DJs and discuss new releases and tours and various things, which is not the case these days.
My memory from working in the Midlands in the 70s is that when you guys came round, it was the absolute highlight of our day. You know, it was like Santa Claus turning up.
I know, because we always arrived. In those days, we did lots of, like, giveaways as well, like T-shirts, badges, caps. There was always a little gift. So, yeah, the DJs and presenters were all very welcoming when we'd come along.
Now, Stuart was absolutely a larger-than-life character, wasn't he? What do you remember about him and how life was like working with him in those days?
Stuart Coxhead, as you say, was legendary. He was the most amazing boss I've ever had. He was my first boss, of course, in the music industry, but he guided me well, taught me well. We worked hard. He was very clever. He knew a hit when he heard a hit. He should have been in A&R, actually. And he was very kind. And he steered a lot of major careers with people that I've worked with over the years and people that have gone on to do many, you know, sort of senior posts in the record industry. There's a young guy called Chris Nuttall, who's actually the owner and managing director of All Around the World Records. He was our junior at the time, and I remember Stuart saying to me, "Terry, I've got a special project for you." He said, "I've got a young lad who wants to go into the music business." And I went, "Oh yeah." And he said, "I'm going to put him on the road with you for 3 months, and you need to train him, teach him about promotion and, you know, the industry in general." And now Chris Nuttall owns his own record label and he's very, very senior. And lots of people valued Stuart's training. He just steered so many people in the right direction and he did it with great kindness as well.
What sort of bands were you working on in those days?
Well, when I first started with Phonogram with Stuart, we launched the career of Dire Straits. I remember working with Mark Knopfler and the band. And the very first TV show I booked, which was with Tony Wilson at Granada TV. He had a late night programme, music programme, and Dire Straits did their very first TV there. We worked with Thin Lizzy, Status Quo, all the early Phonogram bands. You know, we went round, we covered all the interviews, television, radio, and also certain amount of shops. They did PAs. They worked very hard. They schlepped around the country and promoted themselves very well. So we had a good roster.
And later, of course, you worked with Stuart in his own company, Bullet. This was the era of the great, if I may say so, independent pluggers like Ferret and Spanner. You guys had a lot of influence, I think, over what was played on the radio in those days.
Oh, it was amazing. It was the most fantastic experience. Stuart set up his own independent sales and promotion company and moved to London, called Bullet, as you say. And he brought the whole team from Phonogram, which, of course, Phonogram weren't very pleased about at the time. And we set up this independent promotion company, which was actually quite a new thing in those days. You know, to actually be independent was quite rare. And we took on so many incredible contracts. We had the Stiff Records contract, which was just amazing, the amount of records and hits we had with them. And we did a lot of smaller independent labels. I mean, we also worked with Depeche Mode in the very early days, Alison Moyet in Yazoo, Wham with George Michael and Andrew. You know, we did Wham Rap. That was their very first hit. And we just had a magical time, you know, sort of working with these incredible artists, and that was again all headed by Stuart Coxhead.
So in more recent years, Terry, Stuart's gone off and done a lot of management. He looked after Acoustic Alchemy, didn't he? But
yes,
you've stayed
plugging. What would you say are the big differences now, 30, 40 years on from your early days in the business?
Oh, it's just an amazing change over the years. The group radio stations, the playlists, we used to go in and chat to individual people about playlists and plays and interviews. But now, most of the radio stations in the UK are now run by the big group networks. So it's not the same kind of... You don't have that liaison, you don't have that one-to-one. Not so much. You still have a nice, very good professional relationship, but it's not the same as it was, where we could go in and sit and have a cup of tea with the DJs and basically just, you know, talk about all the music and things that were happening in their area. Because it was all, we always did regional. So it was really important, you know, that when you were in, you know, Trent in Nottingham or BR&B in Birmingham and Manchester, that we talked about what was happening in their area because they were very local.
It's easy to get quite nostalgic about all that, Terry, isn't it?
I know, yeah.
We'll all miss Stuart, won't we?
Yeah. I mean, it's still very raw because he passed away last Saturday and I can't believe he's gone. He was just such He was a major influence in my life and I can thank him from the bottom of my heart for everything he did for me. So sorry, Trevor. I'm a little bit emotional because he was just, as you say, a larger-than-life character. He was big heart, a big, big man and a big heart. And he'll be sadly missed.
Terry, a lot of people will have a lot of sympathy for what you're saying. Everybody will miss. As Stuart Cox said, thank you very much for coming on the podcast to talk about Stuart. That's Terry Doherty. And this is the Radio Today programme. Let's go and find out what's been going on this week in history, as they used to say on commercial radio, with David Lloyd.
You and David Lloyd, Radio Moments.
Happy birthday, stereo. This week, 57 years ago, regular stereo transmissions in London began, but not without some complications.
Well, you need two receivers to hear this broadcast stereophonically. The one on the left should be tuned to Network 3, preferably on VHF, and the right-hand receiver to BBC television sound. The loudspeakers should be about the same height from the floor and spaced 6 to 10 feet apart. And by the way, if your television set is one which has the loudspeaker mounted in one side, it'll be better if you can turn the set round so that the loudspeaker faces forwards.
That's how the early days worked, the first regular stereo broadcasting this week in 1958. And it's 5 years now since that stereo was made available in another way.
In the UK, between 4 and 5 million people a month listen to the radio on the internet, but they don't tend to listen for very long periods at a time. And we think this is because it's really quite hard to use like a radio. So the BBC and commercial radio have been working together over the last few months to come up with a model for a UK radio player.
Mike Hill playing with his radio player this week 5 years ago. Now, of course, a quarter of the population listen online in the course of a month. To Scotland now, and this week sees a 35th commercial anniversary.
So make it a great day with Radio
Day. Welcome back to Breakfast Beat. It's now 6 minutes to 8 o'clock. Graham Stewart hosts Morning Connection 9 to 12, Monday to Friday on Radio Tay. I think I can best describe Graham by saying that he's a sort of Albert Tatlow on wheels. His programme contains a lot of interesting features and many idiotic mistakes.
Albert Tatlock on wheels, goodness. Radio Tay, which launched from its Angus transmitter this week in 1980. Also, happy birthday this week to commercial radio in Gloucestershire.
Another radio station's just joined the independent local radio network. Seven Sound, broadcasting from Gloucester, became the 25th commercial station just a couple of minutes ago at 6 o'clock.
We're playing. Mm-hmm. You've got a friend on Seven Sound Radio.
Radio.
Stereo Seven Sound.
95.
The days when a news station was national news, Seven Sound, launching this week in 1980. It's now Heart. Brand changes happen frequently on commercial radio, but the BBC's had its fair share too.
10 years.
affairs of news, weather reports, bus timetables, information for glasshouse growers, greyhound results, angling news, lost cats, record requests, sea conditions, church bells, and literally thousands of broadcasts by Brightonians for Brightonians.
Thank you, Kate Adey, who started on what was BBC Radio Brighton. 32 years ago this week, that station changed its name.
Radio Sussex News headlines, this is Richard Linfield.
It's 17 years this week since we lost Frank Gillard. Frank is well remembered for his valiant fight for BBC local radio, and that's why the awards bear his name. But he was also a respected war correspondent.
In this barrage, we've got our 4.2-inch mortars, our field guns, our medium guns, all the guns on the fleet. The shells are whistling overhead now. Just listen to them.
Hear Frank now reflecting from Kenya on the moment a princess became a queen.
How tragic to think that even this morning, as she sat at breakfast, talking about her father and proudly describing how bravely he'd stood up to his illness and how well he'd recovered, sitting there in her yellow bush shirt and brown slacks. Even at that moment, her father was lying dead, and she had succeeded to his vast responsibilities.
Frank Gillard, who died this week in 1998, I actually have a copy here of the BBC Handbook 1967, page 20, and Frank Gillard writes in here, he says, the BBC's postbag still consistently includes more correspondence on radio than on television matters. People who work in radio are continually reminded that their medium holds great responsibilities. 93 years ago this week, the British Broadcasting Company was formed.
Last year, the manufacturers of wireless apparatus met together by invitation of the Post Office, as it was realised that broadcasting would have to be controlled by one broadcasting authority if the chaos which today is so obvious in America were to be avoided here.
The chairman of the BBC speaking in the early days of that new amalgamated company of manufacturers.
I want you to understand that in addition to trying to protect our 600 manufacturing members, we have never lost sight of the interests of the general public. We are not going to stop broadcasting. Broadcasting has come to stay.
So, did the BBC avoid chaos? Well, this week in 2008 saw Saxgate.
Andrew Sachs, I said some things I didn't have oughta, like I had sex with your granddaughter, but it was consensual and she wasn't menstrual.
Jonathan Ross and Russell Brand on Radio 2, heads rolled this week 7 years ago. 1974 now, and the beginnings of commercial radio in Liverpool.
I think we all started about 2 weeks before the station went on the air, because there was a period where they have test transmissions and they had to try out all the studio gear. And the studios were ready, more or less, for that 2 weeks prior to going on air time. But the building wasn't. I remember right the way up until the day before, it was quite chaotic, and everybody from the managing director to the chairman to all the news people, who are now big names, some of them, we were all humping furniture around.
Dave Lincoln remembering Radio City, which launched this week 41 years ago. So with Radio Mercury launching 33 years ago in Surrey.
1521 and 102.7.
The death of Tony Capstick 12 years ago.
This is Radio Sheffield. You've just been told that, so shut up, I'm not going to tell you for another 5 minutes.
The final Fluff Saturday rock show on Formidable 1FM 22 years ago.
And don't forget, I love you.
BRMB going 24 hours 39 years ago.
They're all here on BRMB 261. Adrian Just, Ed Doolin, George Ferguson, Robin Falk, Brian Stavin, David Jameson, Nicky Steele, Martin Stunt, John Russell.
What? And the fresh 40 chart launching on Kiss and Galaxy with Dynamite MC this week 9 years ago. Those are this week's Radio Moments.
Radio Moments!
Thank you, David. Credits this week also to David Hepworth and Mark Allen for the Word in Your Ear session, Terry Doherty, Roy Martin, and of course you for listening. More next week on a subsequent Radio Today programme, if you fancy it. Ta-da!
The Radio Today programme with broadcast by Onyx.